You're listening to a talk presented by the Brisbane City Bible Forum. Thank you for listening.
We've all got history in this area of love, lust, and sexuality. I'm going to tell you a little bit of my history, a little bit of overshare, but then I'll tell you why I'm going to overshare in just a moment. When I was in second class, we had this really unfortunate kind of circumstance. We were doing swimming lessons, and there was actually a pool close to the school grounds. And the boys, there was a room where the bags were stored, and the boys had to get changed in the bag room, and the girls got changed in the classroom. The problem was that the room where the boys got changed was the bag room where the girls went to get their bags to get changed after swimming. Now, it was only seven, right? But on one particular day, one of my friends, he's actually my second cousin or 42nd cousin or something like that. So what you used to do is arrange with a friend for them to hold a towel in front of you while you got changed in the room in case a girl walked in to get a bag. You can see where this is going, right? So this friend, so-called friend, you know, was holding a towel in front of me one day when into the bag room came a girl. Now, they were supposed to get their bags and leave, but invariably one of them would forget or run late. And in came this girl. Her name was Hannah. And although I was only, whatever it is, seven or eight at the time, I liked her because she had really long pigtails. And so there was a little bit of a, you know, I liked her, whatever that looks like when you're seven or eight. And my friend is holding a towel in front of me. And she came into the room. And for some reason, he just decided to let it go when I was starkers. And so there I was, exposed, and she happened to be getting the bag not over there, but over here. So, how do I put this? Although that was a small thing, and I was very young, she and her family owned the pharmacy in the town of Forbes where I grew up. I was a farm boy. I could not go into the pharmacy, and you know, I just couldn't go into the pharmacy in case she was there. I avoided her. If we were in class together, it didn't really matter. But if there was some kind of direct thing, I kind of never really got over it. And eventually, she went off to a private school in Sydney or somewhere, and I was saved. We've all got history in this area of love, lust, and sexuality. But that's not the worst of it. For me, I got caught up in pornography in my teens, and it just got worse. I won't go into any details, you don't want to know scandalous details, but pornography by its nature is unfulfilling in all sorts of ways, and so I got really trapped in it, quite deeply trapped. Awful, horrible experience, and you know, really affected how I think of myself. Now you're thinking, Glenn, whoa, thanks for the overshare. I didn't come here for that. The reason I want to talk about this is I want to be open about this because we're going to talk about the topic of love and lust and sex and sexuality. And I just want to say we've all got history. We've all got history in this area. And so it actually can be hard to talk about, and it can be hard to hear someone talking about it because we've got history, and the history is on the topic of sex and sexuality and love and lust, which is a big deal. And it's a big deal because it touches on our identity and our sense of self and all those things. So I guess I just wanted the person who's kind of speaking to you put a bit of my history out there so you can see that I'm not talking from a position of I've got this all sorted and that my life is, you know, one pure good sexual fantasy. It's not. It's complicated and messy and like most people's. All right. So what I'm going to do is pick up on four ideas. Picking up, we're working through the book of Proverbs. But first point is, I'm going to tell you the four points are, and then we'll cover them, a simple format, and then speak for about 20 minutes, and then open up for question and answer and comment in our forum style. First point, Christianity's understanding of sex is get naked. Christianity's understanding of sex is get naked. I'll tell you what that means soon. Secondly, though, it's easy to get naked in an unfulfilling or a misdirected way. Easy to get naked in an unfulfilling or misdirected way. Third, Jesus is the answer to being naked before God. And then the fourth point is being naked before God enables us to be naked before each other. So Jesus is the answer, to being naked before God. Being naked before God is the basis of being naked for each other. So Christianity's understanding of sex and sexuality is get naked. I have not gone with many pictures in this series. You can understand why. But a hint of complaint there. Well, there we go. Sorry about that. Here it is from the Bible, Proverbs 5. We didn't read it out. Let me read it out. What you have on your outline is chapters 5 and 6 from the book of Proverbs. Let me read out a little bit of the text there. This is halfway through, but it's on there. It's in that highlight box. It says, drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. The iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he's held fast in the cords of his sin. He dies for lack of discipline, and because of his great folly, he's led astray. So, straight out of that bit of text is this. The book of Proverbs is written as a son, primarily as it's written as a father to his son to say, this is how you should live out if you are one of the people who follow God. But more broadly in the Bible, it's understood as God speaking to his children. So you might need to translate if there's too much male language here, but the framework is, yeah. So this is part of the proverb. May the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, graceful doe, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight, be intoxicated always in her love. Now, actually, the original reads a little bit closer to this. The wife of your youth, a lovely deer, graceful doe, let her breasts ravish you at all times, be led astray always in her love. The language of be led astray is deliberately used. It's contrasted to, in the book of Proverbs, the adulteress or the tempting woman or the prostitute. And it says, don't be led astray by her, but with your wife. With your wife, be led astray. Now, that's quite an invitation. See, interesting, sex in the Bible, across the Bible, is, three things. It's variable. You know what? There's no comment on how you have sex. The Christian position is that there isn't one. How, when, in what way? All sorts of possibilities. So, you know, the joke of the missionary position, it doesn't exist. But the Bible does reflect on who. Marriage is the framework between a man and a woman. So it does reflect on who, between a man and a woman in marriage. But the third thing, variable who, marriage, or in what way. Thirdly, it's about intimacy. And the way the Bible picks that up is with the idea of nakedness. Nakedness is what's used to describe it. Now, this is more than just intimacy. Nakedness is about being known. About being known, being naked before the person. Let me try and explore that some more. See, the physical nakedness in the Bible reflects emotional and spiritual nakedness. So that physical nakedness that the Bible picks up on reflects kind of spiritual and emotional nakedness. That physical joining in sex reflects spiritual and emotional joining. So what does that look like? It's supposed to look like you're accepted just as you are. That's someone telling me that they can't find the venue. Sorry. You're loved just as you are. And you get to love just as you are. And that creates deep, fulfilling intimacy. So let me show you just how positive a view of sex and sexuality exists in the Bible. In the very first page of the Bible, God makes man and woman, and they stand naked before God, and this is celebrated. It's celebrated. They're naked before each other. They're naked for sex, one flesh, and they're naked before God. So this is first Genesis, start of the Bible. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. It's talking about sex. So man's created, and the first thing that's on the agenda is sex, the sexual union. And they were naked. And what? We're not ashamed. Really incredibly positive view of sex and sexuality. There they stand before God, physically naked, for sex, emotionally naked, spiritually naked, in the very presence of God. You can't, it's hard to get a more positive picture than that. Now, coming back to our bit of Proverbs, where does this go? This bit's hard to understand a little bit, but exploring this idea of being naked. This is what the proverb says. It says, drink water from your own cistern. You can see it there on your outline. Flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets? I think this is saying, it's a metaphor, so it's a little tricky. I think this is saying, young man or man, if you have a wife, she is your source of sexual intimacy and pleasure. And you are the source of her sexual intimacy and pleasure. And so give yourselves to each other. Have sex and lots of it. Be coming back to that earlier part, be led astray by each other. So the picture here is of a stream or a fountain bubbling up, that a man and a woman loving each other, it bubbles up into their life. And if they don't do that, then that stream flows out onto the street, where it gets mixed up with cigarette butts and gets dirty and foul and dried up. It's outside the fountain, but between a man and a woman. Giving to each other, be led astray by each other, in each other, flows up like a fountain. See, what it's saying is that great sex in a great relationship is great for you. Because the other image of this fountain, I think that's why it's a metaphor, is showing that it's not just between you as a couple, but it flows up in life. It leads to a better, more prosperous, more stable life. And the data is in that says this is exactly the case. Stable marriages, there was something in the Daily Mail in the UK just a couple of weeks ago, basically saying stable marriages lead to better economic success, better education, better health for your children, and men work harder, they get further in their career, they're more disciplined, they make more sacrifices, and women benefit as well. If you wanted to pick that up, you could look up the Weekend Australian magazine from about 6 months ago, an article called For Better or Worse. It talks exactly about that. The data is in that when men get married younger, it's better for everyone. So great sex in a great relationship is great for you and society. See, this fountain idea here is a picture of how sex and love and lust should work. It should build depth and intimacy and excitement. You are to lead each other astray into each other. I know that sounds weird, but just trying to overcome that kind of... See, I mean, the cash value of this is if you're a wife, keep buying lingerie, keep inflaming your husband's love and lust for you. Husbands, the cash value for this is love and cherish your wife during the day, and it will build for erotic sex in the bedroom at night. And that reflects the two different ways men and women work. Again, the data is in on that as well. But let me prove to you that what the Bible's saying here is true. Got that? Right, anyway, it's all a bit complicated. But basically, yeah, it's basically saying chemically, that's exactly how it works. And what the easier thing to do is to watch this video, Eros, Intimacy and the Mind of God by Dr. Patricia Wirikoon. She's a University of Sydney sexologist, a leading researcher. She's now retired. She gave our Smith lecture on this topic a couple of years ago. And Russell was the fifth man through the door, so gets our door prize. And you can give it away if you don't want it, but it's really good. You're the most depraved, and you should get it. Well, so it's interesting, though. Our society doesn't understand this. So here's the classic example. The company Ashley Madison. And you know what the fallen down thing on the O is there? It's a wedding ring that's fallen over. I don't know if you've been up too late watching TV, and you may have seen the ads. There's a couple. They run into the bedroom together. They're like, you're looking in the long shot to a bedroom. He runs in and heads in and lies on the bed. And this woman comes after him, undressing, keen to be with him, ready. And it says these words. It says, they're married. not to each other. That's the point. Life is short, have an affair. It's saying you can't find erotic fulfillment within a marriage. You have to find it elsewhere. That's life is short. If you want to find pleasure, if you want to find enjoyment, if you want the depth of all your sexuality offers, you have to find it outside the bedroom of a husband and wife. Yeah, go for it, Scott.
I think things like this, they're not actually saying this is what you should be like. It's that they know that this kind of entertainment sells.
Have an affair. It's telling you, it's encouraging you to do it.
Is it just a TV show, did you say?
Oh, there's a TV ad for it, but that's just off their website.
But what is it, a show? Or a...
No, it's sign up. You sign up, you register yourself for yourself. No, no. I was talking about an ad that was on. No, you sign up on a website and you register yourself and you pay some money and they will put you in contact with someone else who wants a discreet affair. That billboard was up. And you think, Glenn, you shouldn't be showing that here. That billboard was up on Bow Desert Road not that long ago. I'm glad for you if you didn't see it. And I'm sorry if this is hard for you to see, but that's what our society and culture thinks. So that makes... this Christianite...
I think that's a minority position.
Okay, yeah, okay. Society is too...
it's wrong to say that society...
too strong a word.
Well, I think society... I think you're wrong, though. The rates are like 1 in 2 of people having affairs in certain age groups. There's a married people, that is. It's prevalent, it's out there.
It's out there. But I'm happy to say... I actually should say we, because I want to include Christians in society. So, see, we live in this world... it has this very strong flavour running through it. Is that better? Happy with that?
I'll accept that.
Good. Okay. No, it's good. It's good. And I didn't want to characterise it as... the whole point of me, the introduction, is not to say, oh, we Christians, we don't have this, and society... I'm not trying to do that. So that's helpful to hear. So, but the Bible's perspective is that marriage is the place for that deepening, growing intimacy. In fact... in the Old Testament, the law of God was that when a man was first married, he was commanded to stay at home for a year with his wife to make her happy. He was not allowed to join the army. He wasn't allowed to join military campaigns. He wasn't allowed to travel. Well, it doesn't really get into details, but he wasn't allowed to travel for business. He had to stay in the bedroom. Well, maybe not the bedroom. He had to stay at home. Okay. Now, point two. So Christians' understanding of sex and sexuality is get naked in the context of marriage, but get naked. It's intimacy, it's good. Point two, it's easy to get naked in an unfulfilling and misdirected way. Let me show you this quote. This is the kind of picks up again on that. This is from a TED talk that was given. This lady, Esther Perel, has written on desire in long-term relationships. And she says this. Well, she just kind of picks up on this idea. Yet a passionate marriage. Now, there's a contradiction in terms. Passion has always existed, but mostly outside the conjugal bed. It's kind of true. It's hard to have this growing sense of intimacy and desire. It's hard because of other people and ourselves. It's hard because we're actually all broken in this area, with unfulfilled desires and misdirected desires. Let me try and prove my case to you. It's actually Solomon. Solomon is understood to be the author of the majority of the book of Proverbs. And he in here, if he wrote this, is saying, you know, within marriage, that's how it should work. Sexual intimacy is good, but it's wonderful inside marriage. And interestingly, when it says, don't go with an adulteress, the actual Hebrew word is don't go with a foreign woman. That's actually true. Don't go with a foreign woman. So how did that work for King Solomon? Well, when he got old, it says this. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, the Moabite, the Ammonites, the Edomites, Sidonians, and the Hittite women. But he wasn't supposed to be married to any of them. Solomon clung to these women in love. He had 700 wives and princesses, and 300 concubines. Now, 700 wives and 300 concubines, And did he really? Did he really have that many? There's one proverb that makes me think that he just might have. See, most of the proverbs in the Bible, in the book of Proverbs, they don't repeat. They might have the same idea, but they say it quite differently, or variations. They're playful. But there's one proverb that gets repeated almost exactly word for word that I think makes me think that maybe Solomon had 300 wives and princesses. It's this one. It is better to live in a corner of the housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. And that one, word for word. You're not smart. I was kidding, all right? I mean, it's a joke, all right? Obviously not a very good one. So, see, the point here is that Solomon, the greatest and wisest man that ever lived, couldn't live out his own proverb. And this brokenness, I think this unfulfilled desire, this misplaced desire. See, think about, why did he have whatever number it is? Why did he have 700 wives and concubines? I mean, you know, that's a different wife every night for 2 years and a different concubine every night for almost a year. He gets the weekends off. What? Why? Why would you need, not 700, why would you need 100? Why would you need 50?
Evolution, baby.
Symbol of power.
Yeah, symbol of power, evolution, baby. So he's just lying around in bed. He's bored. No television. That's what it was. No, because it doesn't... Times were good. Collect wives. Some people collect matchbox cars. Solomon collected wives. Quite possibly, you're right. But what I think it points to this critical issue. See, it shows that Solomon was actually unfulfilled in this area. He was unfulfilled in this area, which is why he kept collecting them. He thought that one more wife and one more concubine, maybe it was partly political because of the nations around them, but why do your politics like that? He's actually unfulfilled. And if you read that passage around his life, you see that in 1 Kings 11.
I think it's more likely that he didn't have sex with all of them.
No, they were just trophies.
Yeah, that's right, that's why he had 300.
Oh, yeah, but even if it's half of them, or even if it's a fifth of them, it's still, yeah, you know, kind of crazy numbers, isn't it? See, I think this is saying that if we look to sex, or even more broadly, love to fulfill us, it won't. Even in marriage. I think that's even in marriage. See, it is fulfilling, and yet it's not ultimately fulfilling. Some people have been married for a long time who have great relationships and maybe even great sex, they'll still say, it's great, but it doesn't reach all those amazing heights that it could all the time, and sometimes not often. Patricia Wirikun, the sexologist, says she interviews lots of couples and says that people who look for fulfillment in sexual highs, even in marriage, it becomes destructive because you can't do it. It's not as good as it ought to be. See, sex and sexuality is a really good thing, but it's not the greatest thing. Love in relationships is a really good thing, but it isn't the greatest thing. And this is pointing to that if it becomes an ultimate thing, it's destructive. It's an ultimate desire that can never be satisfied. So where does Christianity go with that? Well, there's a New Testament passage, and we come to the third point here. See, Jesus is the answer to desire, and Jesus is the answer to being naked before God. It sounds like a big leap. Let me try and explain it. There's a story of Jesus in Gospel of John, meeting a woman at a well. And see, the interesting thing about the story is he asks her to get some water. And she says, I can't. And then he offers her water. And it's the idea of a fountain. He says, in me, you will find a fountain that springs up into your life and flows out. And she says, sir, I want this water. Now, the interesting thing is, she's probably, very, very likely, a scandalous woman. There's a couple of things that hint to that. Why is she getting water in the middle of the day at a well? She's not really the place to be there. And what is Jesus doing speaking with her? So there's a hint of scandal there. But then Jesus says to her, go and get your husband. And it turns out she lives with a man who's not her husband. and she's had four more. Is she just unlucky in love? Or is something else going on? See, she's a scandalous woman. She's the adulteress or prostitute. And she's a woman of unfulfilled desire. See, I think it's deliberate that the fountain language is picked up. It's picking up on Proverbs. She can't find it. Now, it might be that her husbands have let her down, or she keeps changing them. You don't know how the five arise, but there's this picture of lack of fulfillment. And Jesus says to her, I will give it to you. And how will that be so? Well, the first part is that Jesus' death for you. You know you are loved. Second part is, in Jesus' death for you, in which John's gospel takes you, is that you know that you're accepted by God. See, whatever you're like, however you've failed, especially in this area, the Bible's saying that Jesus died for you. And so God accepts you. So whatever our brokenness is, what our misdirected desire, unfulfilled desire, things we've done that are wrong or complicated or messy, just like this woman, well, she is accepted by Jesus. And we can be accepted by Jesus. See, the idea is we are naked before God, and we can come to him as we are with all our messiness and be accepted because of what Jesus did on the cross. Our messiness is fixed up and cleaned up in Jesus. But there's one more step here. So the Bible says that God's Spirit then comes into your life to fill you and fill that deeper desire. That desire that's even deeper than the desire for sex and love, which is to be known. To be known by your Creator. To be intimate with your Creator. To be naked before him. However you are, whatever you've done, to be able to stand in his presence and be accepted. So then the fourth point, and I'll move really quickly here. That takes us then, if we're naked before God, we have a basis to be naked before each other. See, at the moment, a big part of our society is to cohabitate before you marry. That is, you know, you live together before you marry. And last week in the Courier Mail, or a couple of days ago, they interviewed a bunch of people and they said, you know, is this the best thing to do, to live together before you get married? You know, try before you buy, or just to you know, work it out by living together. And everyone said yes. But the data is in, and it's called the cohabitation effect. Oh, here it is. The cohabitation effect. See, you'd think common sense would tell you that that works, right? If you try before you buy in living together and in a relationship, you can work out if it's going to work well. But the data is in that it doesn't work. There was a New York Times article from 2012 by a clinical psychologist which caused a huge stir. She says this, I'll quote. She says, that belief of cohabitation leading to good long-term relationships is contradicted by experience. And the data. Couples who cohabitate before marriage, and especially before an engagement or an otherwise clear commitment, tend to be less satisfied with their marriages and more likely to divorce than couples who do not. These negative outcomes are called the cohabitation effect. And the data is in for Australia as well. It says this is from a long-term government research into Australian children. This was in the Week in Australian magazine earlier this year. It says young families with cohabitating parents are nearly three times more likely to break up than married families, 19% compared to 7% of marriage separated within 4 years. Now, why? Well, there's a few answers, but here's a big one. Let me quote from Jennifer from the New York Times article, this article, and there's a quote from this lady. She says this. She says, I felt like I was on this multi-year, never-ending audition to be his wife. She moved in with this guy and living with him, and they were trying to see how it worked. Was it going to be good? But it was hard to be naked before each other, spiritually and emotionally, because you're trying it out. You're testing the waters. You're on show. You're on show. Like, if they're trying it before we buy it, I need to keep the standard up. I need to always look pretty. I need to make sure that I perform well in the bedroom. I need to maybe not reveal who I truly am, my best and worst, because then the person might decide, well, I've tried you and I don't like you, so I'm out of here. That's her language. She says, I felt like I was on this multi-year, never-ending audition to be his wife. See, the cohabitation effect, one of the reasons it happens is because it's actually hard. If you don't have that commitment, that bond of marriage, that trust, you said, I've committed to you better for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, for good sex or bad sex, I'm committed to you. If you don't have that, you're always an audition. If you have that, then you can be naked before each other in every sense. That's the Bible's argument. But see, if we get this right, if we understand that we can be naked before God, that we, in Him, we can have confidence about who we are and what we're like, and we're accepted and known by our Creator, that actually creates the basis to be naked with each other. Well, not with each other. With your husband or wife. It creates that basis where you can be confident to reveal who you are and what's going on for you, and have trust and be trusted and love and be loved. So the argument of the Bible is that actually Christianity is that being naked is good and great. But it's actually really easy for our nakedness to be misdirected into misdirected desire or unfulfilled desire. But the way forward is to grasp who God is and how much He accepts us, and the basis of that acceptance in Jesus. And then because of that trust and confidence in God, naked before God, the basis on which to be naked with someone else. Let me stop there, and it opened up for questions.